The first case on our agenda is Bowles versus Sun Herbaline, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
If it pleases the court, my name is Jim Scherer. I'm attorney for the petitioner, Savannah Bowles. Now, this is an appeal from a summary judgment which was issued by the Denver District Court in favor of the respondent in this case, Sun Herbaline, Inc. The case involves injuries which Ms. Bowles suffered at a Executive Cans canning franchise on March 12, 2004. On that morning, Ms. Bowles appeared at the Executive Cans outlet for an indoor canning session. She was checked in, and after she checked in, she was shown to a canning room with a Sun Herbaline 254 or 252 upright canning booth. This is a walk-in booth, a cylindrical booth about 6.5 feet high with ultraviolet lamps around the sides for canning. At the top of the booth, there was a large commercial-grade fan, exhaust fan, and the fan was protected by a fan guard, concentric circular wires. Fan guard, as manufactured, had a gap around the sides of the fan guard, such wide enough so that a finger could easily pass through the guard and contact the moving fan blades. Ms. Bowles put on dark glasses to protect her eyes, stepped into the booth, turned it on, and reached above her head for handles, which she believed were there to hold on to. As she did, her right hand passed through the fan guard and contacted the moving fans of the exhaust fan, moving blades of the exhaust fan, partially amputating the index and middle fingers of her right hand. Ms. Bowles brought her action in the trial court against Sun Herbaline and also against the canning booth manufacturer and the manufacturer of the fan and fan guard assembly. The claim against Sun Herbaline was based on a theory of strict products liability. At the time that Ms. Bowles checked in for her March 2004 canning session, she signed what was called an executive cans canning release form, and that is in the record. And what it stated in relevant part was that Ms. Bowles released executive cans, franchisers, employees, and manufacturer from any liability for any harm which she, or injury which she may suffer at the executive cans outlet during her canning session. After the case was filed, Executive Cans brought a motion for summary judgment based upon the release, stating that the release was valid to release Sun Herbaline from liability.
Counsel, yeah. Generally a contract is made between two parties, and why can't she do that? Why can't she totally release the manufacturer?
Well, this court has taking a look at the issue of exculpatory agreements, releases, such as involved in this case on a number of occasions. As a general proposition, yes, people, you know, there's a heavy, high regard for freedom of contract under Colorado law. However, exculpatory agreements are a special case. And this court has recognized that they're a special case. And the court has laid down a fundamental principles as to when and under what circumstances they may be enforced. And what this court has held repeatedly is that a release of liability will not be enforced, notwithstanding it was freely and voluntarily made, where a compromise is recognized public policy. And our position basically in this proceeding is that the release that was signed in this case does severely, substantially impact the public policy underlying the doctrine of strict liability as it's been adopted.
Mr. Scherer, what's the public policy about tanning? tanning centers. How does that fit into that rationale?
I missed the last part of your question.
How does that fit into the rationale you just gave? What's the public policy that we should consider to use for us, all of us, to go to tanning centers?
Well, there isn't one, quite frankly, Your Honor. As I said before, we had brought the claim also against Executive Tans on a negligence theory. Executive Tans also filed a motion for summary judgment saying, essentially, in relevant part, that indoor tanning is not an essential activity and therefore no public policy is implicated by the release as it applies to Executive Tans. That was granted. We're not here on...
You're right. I'm sorry. I didn't phrase the question correctly. I apologize. I meant the manufacturer of the product here, which is used for tanning. You're right.
Right. I think I understood, and I was... I think the distinction that needs to be made is that as the release applies to Sun Ergoline and the claims against Sun Ergoline, the release does not relate to tanning. Rather, it relates to Sun Ergoline's legal liability for placing a defective and dangerous product into the stream of commerce for use by consumers.
So is your answer that the public policy relates to the nature of this claim, that is product's liability, or does it relate to the nature of the relationship with the manufacturer?
It relates to the nature of the claim, and in particular, the fact that the claim is based upon a very strict product's liability.
Then what is it about the nature of that tort that is different that calls for a different public policy consideration?
Than negligence?
Yes.
Well, as the court's well aware, product's liability is a separate and distinct theory from negligence. You do not need to show negligence in strict product's liability. Essentially, what you have to show is that a manufacturer who has placed a item in the stream of commerce for sale or use by consumers is responsible for injury caused by that product where the product is defective and unreasonably dangerous, notwithstanding that there was no negligence involved. The doctrine of strict product's liability has been in effect in this state for about 30 years. And if you look at the case law, certainly from this court, justifying the adoption and application of strict product's liability, it is based on a very fundamental, very important public interest. And that public interest is essentially to shift the burden of injuries caused by defective products from consumers suffering those injuries to the manufacturer, shift that responsibility based on a number of factors, the first being that manufacturers are in a better position to assess and ameliorate dangerous conditions in their product, that manufacturers are in a position to obtain liability insurance to cover losses caused by injuries caused by defective products.
What did your complaint allege was the actual problem or defect in this tanning bed?
We brought it on a design defects theory.
And that was that it related to the design of the tanning bed itself?
No, it related to the design of the fan guard that was installed in the tanning bed. Around the sides of the fan guard, the wire grill was about 3/4 of an inch wide, very wide, very easy enough for somebody to get their finger in. And our theory in the trial court was that design, and apparently this wasn't a manufacturing defect, this is the way it was supposed to be manufactured. Apparently there were a lot of injuries from the fan. The design itself was defective and unreasonably dangerous.
So product was manufactured to specifications, it's just that the design itself was the problem from your point of view?
Exactly.
Okay.
Counsel, before you move on, can I bring you back to Justice Martinez's questions about strict liability? I mean, you're basically, I think, hanging your hat on the fact that this is a strict liability claim, and therefore you cannot waive or release liability for strict liability? Is that the essence of your argument?
Well, that's for the court to decide, certainly. Our argument.
Well, I'm asking what you, yeah, what you're arguing.
Our argument is essentially yes, that given the unique nature of strict products liability, and given the fundamental public policy interest which underlies the doctrine and the use of the doctrine in the state, the use of releases to absolve manufacturers from liability under strict product liability, certainly in typical consumer transactions, would frustrate that policy. This court has delineated certain areas where these releases are effective, essentially in recreational activities, skydiving in the Jones versus Dressel, horseback riding in the Chadwick versus Colebrook Outfitters. You find that where this court has permitted the use or the effectiveness of these releases, they have proliferated.
They have, I'm sorry to hear you.
Proliferated. They're in very common use. You can't go skydiving without signing release,
sure,
no matter where you go.
But help us understand, how is going into a tanning booth different from that? I mean, are you not expected to sign a release form when you go to a tanning booth?
Well, yeah, I think it's pretty common to do that. I don't tan myself, given the dangers inherent to it, but which I'll get to.
But I guess, back to my question then, if you're basing this on the strict liability nature of the fundamental claim that you're bringing, what do you do with the third restatement that seems to have moved away from strict liability?
You know, I read that in counsel's brief, and I think it was a very well done brief, but I don't agree with this analysis. I do not read Restatement Third as incorporating negligence principles into strict liability doctrine. I think this court, certainly, and courts in other states, have made extraordinary efforts to keep negligence principles out of strict products liability, given the nature and basis of the doctrine. I would concede that in a failure to warn case, necessarily given the nature of that basis for product liability, that there are some negligence concepts necessarily incorporated. Certainly on a design defect case, there is no.
Well, how do you prove that something is defective, though? I mean, aren't those negligence principles incorporated? I mean, what I think you're saying is, once you show something is defective, then there's liability. That's the strict liability part. But getting to show or proving that something is defective, or a defective design, don't you incorporate negligence principles into that inquiry?
Your Honor, I think the short answer is no, and I'm trying to recall the exact parameters for a design defect strict product liability case, and it's not simple, but in a simple case, and this is a very simple design defect case, the showing essentially needs to be that there was another design available that would reduce or eliminate the dangerous nature of the product as it was in fact designed. In this case, you know, our argument would simply be that there was another design available, to stick another wire in there so people can't put their fingers in it. But that has nothing to do with negligence.
Are you arguing failure to warn in this case?
No.
You're not? I can understand how the failure to warn theory would necessarily negate the idea that you could waive it. Exculpatory should not be an exculpatory waiver should not be effective in that situation. But I'm missing a connection, I think, on why you think it doesn't apply to a design defect case.
Why failure to warn does not apply to a design?
Well, no. Why the exculpatory clause or agreement should not apply in a design defect case?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think it goes back to the public policy underlying the adoption and use of the strict products liability doctrine in this state. It was adopted given the difficulties of proving negligence of a manufacturer who sells a defective product that's causing injury to consumers. And it is based on the principle that the entity which should by right be responsible for bearing the burden of those injuries caused by defective and dangerous products should be the manufacturer. This state, this court, made a decision starting with Heigl versus General Motors Corp. back in 1975 that even in the absence of negligence, where there is shown a defective and unreasonably dangerous product, the manufacturer is legally responsible for the injuries caused by the defective nature of that product. And I think that principle holds with full force with respect to a design defect products liability claim.
You're not arguing at all that the exculpatory clause itself was limited to someone others other than the manufacturer. It did say manufacturer. Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, I can. Yes. And that is correct. We did raise that issue in the Court of Appeals. However, the specific issue that the court accepted cert on did not include that issue. It's simply whether the public policy of this state permits enforcement of an exculpatory agreement purporting to prospectively release a manufacturer.
I suppose it seems unusual. You go in, you want to get a tan, you sign an agreement, you think you're probably releasing the tanning company from, like, I guess being burned or whatever one might expect might happen as a result of being tanned, then all of a sudden you put your fingers up in the grill and your fingers are cut off. And that's probably not the kind of thing that you the consumer, are expecting would happen to you when you went to get tanned.
I think that's a very important point, Your Honor. Counsel in his briefs talked about express assumption of risk. And I don't know that that is exactly congruent with a exculpatory agreement. An assumption of risk agreement can be either expressed or implied, as the court knows. An express assumption of risk is a contractual agreement to accept the risk of harm from a known or foreseeable danger. In other words, an inherent danger. Now,
one of the reasons I'm asking you, in this situation, perhaps the consumer didn't really have that in mind when she signed that exculpatory agreement, but am I not right that what you want us to do is to, for all situations where there's an exculpatory agreement, where someone has waived their liability and then gets hurt by a product for which there might be strict liability, to say that exculpatory agreement will never work. You just can't do that anymore.
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to make a fine but I think very important distinction. Let's use an example. Let's say that Ms. Bowles had gone in and she had contracted melanoma, a very deadly skin cancer, as a result of this, her indoor tanning. That is an inherent and well-recognized risk of tanning. Now, if you look at the release form that's at issue here, the release form lists the inherent dangers of indoor tanning, including sunburn, eye damage, premature skin thickening, premature aging of the skin, and skin cancer, including melanoma. Were Ms. Bowles to go to court on a strict products liability claim against Sun Ergoline based on the fact she got melanoma through the use of her machine, I don't think the issue, strictly speaking, would be whether or not the exculpatory agreement which she signed was effective on public policy grounds. Rather, she has acknowledged the risk, she knows the risk that happened, the inherent risk of indoor tanning, and she voluntarily proceeded to do so anyway. I think that in that situation where there's an inherent risk, the exculpatory agreement would not be relevant. What would be relevant is the fact that she simply assumed the risk of the injury which she received. So I think,
Mr. Shira, I'm sort of maybe taken aback a little bit that you think the distinction between that kind of injury, that is cancer, versus the damage to the fingers relates to a question of what the risk is and whether it's inherent. And I wonder whether that is the same as or different than talking about it in terms of what the product was designed to do. In other words, it seems to me that the product wasn't designed to cut off your fingers. The product was designed to affect your skin in a manner which we know causes cancer. So I don't see that in the one hand you're talking about a defective product. In the other hand, you may be talking about a defective product. Is it about that, or is it about the risk?
If I understand the court's question, and going back to Justice Rice's question, I think there has to be, assuming that there is an inherent risk, for example, you know, the tobacco litigation, you know, if I'm a smoker and I'm smoking, I get lung cancer, that's an inherent risk of smoking. If I light up a cigarette, it blows up in my face, that's not an inherent risk. Do I have a claim for product liability against the tobacco industry? The courts have generally said no. Do I have a claim because I've assumed the risk? Essentially, I think the analysis is more complicated, but you know, notwithstanding, you can go ahead and sign a release. You know, do I have a claim if the cigarette blew up in my face, caused burning and injury? Probably yes, because that is not an inherent risk. And I think the point I'm trying to make here is that establishing a per se rule of invalidity for releases in the instance of product liability claims would not affect the manufacturer's ability to defend on assumption of risk for injuries caused by inherent dangers to their products. Unless there's more questions, I would like to reserve.
You may.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, Peter Moisen on behalf of defendants at Eppley Sun Ergolon. The issue to be decided today is relatively straightforward. Does the public policy of this state prohibit a court from enforcing a contract that waives future claims for injuries caused by a defective product? This court has already addressed this issue in the context of injuries that are caused by negligent conduct of a third party. In that context, this court has ruled that a waiver contract can be enforced if it meets four conditions. First, the consumer must have a fair level of bargaining power. Second, the language of the waiver contract must be clear and unambiguous. Third, the waiver contract must be entered into fairly. And fourth, the waiver contract must not violate the public policy in the sense that the contract involves a service or a product that is a matter of necessity in everyday life.
Well, can I ask you, counsel? Let me ask you, well, I don't, do any of these work? Hello?
I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. My question is, when you fairly read this release here, the bulk of it has to do with the risk, following up Justice Martinez's question to the other counsel. You read this release, and it seems to talk about the inherent risk of using the tanning process instead of the sun, I suppose. So when you get to the very bottom, this language on manufacture kind of stuck in at the bottom. What I'm asking you in regard to the four factors you just indicated, is there really a fair warning here to the consumer of this process that the waiver is also made with respect to a design defect in the equipment itself? There's broad language having to do with the facility in this last sentence that's tied into the manufacturer, but everything else that proceeds has to do with the risk of artificial tanning. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor. The same kind of issue has been presented previously to this court in connection with waiver contracts for basic negligence claims. And the issue then was whether a release, a waiver contract, has to specify negligence claims. And I think this concept touches on the question you've just raised. How clear does a release have to be? And that is one of the four factors that a trial court has to look at right now. And it may be that this court wants to modify that four-part test to instruct the trial court to focus on the nature of the risk that's being addressed in the waiver contract. But the four-part test as it stands right now does address the issue of whether the waiver contract clearly and unambiguously addresses the particular risk that's being waived. Here, the trial court did address that factor, but perhaps without the precision that you're looking for, I suspect.
Mr. Moyson, your argument that we should use that four-part test, or that at least that it should be the core of the analysis that we develop, maybe it's modified somewhat, sort of assumes a basic similarity between products liability and general negligence. I want you to address whether that's true, and in particular, a concept that has been expressed is that the focus in products liability is the nature of the product, not the conduct of the manufacturer. How does that concept relate to whether we should start with the negligence test or whether it's really a different arena altogether?
I think that's an important point, but it's not the only point. And the reason being, when this court initially promulgated the four-part test, the authoring justice famously said that the crux of the issue was the court being at the crossroads of two competing principles. On the one hand, it's the principle of the freedom of an individual to enter into a fair contract and assume on behalf of himself or herself personal responsibility for what happens. Competing against that principle is the notion of societal responsibility for the cost of injuries that are inflicted on a person. If we look at it that way, the one side of the scale is really the same, whether we're talking about a theory of strict products liability or a theory of negligence. We're still under the umbrella, if you will, of the notion that society imposes an obligation on people or companies to be responsible for the cost of injuring other people. That policy, that public policy, is competing against alternate public policy that individuals should be free to enter into a fair contract whereby they assume personal responsibility for what happens to them. So in that sense, I think it's the same tension.
Let me ask you, in terms of your framework of this balance of competing concerns, how is that balance different, if at all, between general negligence and products liability?
The difference, in my mind, has to be the same concern that the court had back with Jones versus Dressel. Is it a fair contract? And I think those are the same concerns that the restatement third brought up when it was talking about waiver contracts in the context of products liability claims. The restatement third, the American Law Institute, focuses on whether the consumer had sufficient information and sufficient bargaining power. And those themes are already incorporated in the four-part test that was issued initially by this court.
Okay, so in short, there is no difference in your view. Let me explore that in a slightly different way. Assuming for the moment that we thought the test had some quality in this arena but needed modification, discuss what possible modifications one might consider and why. How do those relate to the difference between the nature of the torts and general negligence versus products liability?
I think your question ties in with the issue that Chief Justice Mularkey astutely pointed out, if you're talking about a category like failure to warn cases, that goes to the very heart of the issue of whether a consumer has adequate information. And I think it would be a very tough row to hoe for a defendant manufacturer to fail to provide adequate warnings, and then once they're sued by an injured consumer, argue that the consumer had sufficient information to make a responsible decision about whether to sign a waiver contract.
Well, may I inquire? It makes sense that when someone goes into a tanning booth, you have just general knowledge that tanning might be bad for your skin. That, therefore, you're in a position to make a responsible decision. But how does it make sense that a consumer who goes into a tanning booth would have any ability to know that the grill was improperly sized so that if you reached your hand up there, you could cut off your fingers?
That's a fair question, Your Honor. And again, the position being advocated by my client is that the court should instruct trial courts to address each situation individually on a case-by-case basis.
And that didn't exactly, well, I guess maybe it did in this case, but this case was decided on a motion for summary judgment, which means that as a matter of law, the judge decided that you didn't have any liability. I gather there wasn't any testimony taken from the woman whose fingers were hurt or from the manufacturer or from anybody else. Is that right?
Not entirely, Your Honor. And I'm afraid we probably didn't make that clear in our briefs that we submitted to the court. This is not a situation where my client filed a motion straight out of the gate. We did take the deposition of the plaintiff, asked about her background with tanning booths, what kind of experience she had, what she saw and didn't see when she went into this particular tanning booth. The position being advocated by my client is that you could have a different outcome if you've got different consumers. If you've got
really?
A consumer.
So tell me about that. So a person who, well, just exactly what you mean, a different kind of person who went into that tanning booth and you might have a different outcome?
Yes, Your Honor. And it goes to the idea.
What are you thinking about specifically?
It goes to the notion that's raised by the restatement third. It asks whether the consumer has sufficient information. So you could have one tanning salon where they just sort of process you through without giving you any instruction, any warning. You could have somebody who's, like my opposing counsel, presumably never used a tanning booth before. In that situation, that person has far less information than a veteran consumer who's used a tanning booth hundreds of times, who had a pretty good instruction from the manager of the salon as to how to use the booth, what to watch out for, and that sort of thing.
How could we write an opinion which would make it clear for judges what our standard is if it's so dependent upon the knowledge of the consumer? If you've used a tan booth, you're not suggesting we say something like, well, if you use the tanning booth 10 times, the exculpatory clause is good, but less than 10, it's not? Surely that's not what you're arguing to us.
True, Your Honor. As it stands right now, the four-part test is being applied by trial judges across the state of Colorado. And in each one of those cases, the trial judge has to receive some information from counsel. Now, if there's a factual dispute, the trial judge can say, I'm going to leave it for a jury to decide. But if the essential...
What would the factual dispute be about, though? About the knowledge of the consumer, and how that might affect the validity of the exculpatory clause?
Correct. For instance,
I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you. Excuse me, but let me just follow
sure.
up so I can focus this question a little bit better. There's not any dispute in this case, is there, that this consumer didn't have any knowledge about grill works and fans? She might have known a lot about tanning, but not about mechanical matters?
We did not inquire about her sophistication on mechanical matters. We did inquire as to how many times she'd used a tanning booth like this before. And the other thing was, I believe we provided the trial court with photographs showing the size of the fan, the actual protective grill that was in question. And we were making the argument that this is something you could see, you could hear. It was pretty open and obvious. Something that she had encountered dozens and dozens of times before. And that makes a factual difference. If you're talking about a novice, you know, some teenage kid going in for the first time, and they've had absolutely no instruction with the salon manager, I think that's a factor that a trial judge should take into account. I think it's something that trial judges do take into account right now when they apply the four-part test on negligence claims. And so it would be the same type of analysis if you're talking about a strict products liability claim. It's really just balancing the right of a competent individual to accept personal responsibility for what happens to them if they've been adequately informed, and it's a service or a product where they have a realistic opportunity to find a better bargain elsewhere.
I want to pick up on that. How could they ever be informed on a design defect? That's the allegation here, that the guard structure of the guard wasn't correct. How could you ever adequately inform somebody on that? Because presumably, if the manufacturer had known about it, they wouldn't have done it that way.
And I've wrestled with that question myself, Your Honor. In this particular case, this is the best way I can answer. In this particular case, for instance, if we had unrebutted, undisputed testimony that the manager said to the consumer, there's a fan up there that's supposed to cool you off while the lights are on. Be sure to keep your fingers away from the grill. Things like that. That would be sufficient to provide somebody with an advisement or notice that they could get hurt because of the way this thing is designed.
Mr. Moyston, I had a little trouble, frankly, hearing the total colloquy between Justice Rice and you. But are you suggesting that the negligence test be applied by every district court in every case when there's a design defect? And so the result would be totally dependent on the factual circumstances that are present. Is that what you said?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that's the outcome right now. If you're talking about negligence cases, can have a different.
Right. But this is brought under a theory of strict liability, right?
Correct.
And we're concerned with the stream of commerce of a manufacturer's device, right?
I missed that last part.
Well, I think the policy concern is we don't want manufacturers to put out in the stream of commerce a defectively designed product which will be consumed by the public, right?
Correct.
So how does that individual case-by-case analysis that you have want us to adopt, how does that address the concern I think that Chief Justice mentioned, and I think that Justice Rice, to the extent I heard, was suggesting, in terms of a rule that can be applied both from a policy standpoint and also practically, summary judgment by courts?
It's really what we've got right now. I keep coming back to the point that the current four-part test is the result of a policy decision by this court that the right of an individual to enter into a fair contract has to trump the social obligation of a defendant to bear the cost of the injuries that are caused. It's the same balancing test that has to be applied in the cases of strict liability. At least that's our position. The case-by-case approach is what's being applied right now by trial courts in negligence cases. And in my view, I think trial courts are equally well equipped to apply that same four-part test in cases involving strict products liability. I mean, courts will be doing the same type of analysis that they've been doing for decades in negligence cases. And it's based on the same public policy concerns that the contract has to be fair, otherwise the courts will not enforce a bargain that a consumer has gone into.
I may have missed your answer, and I apologize. But I think Justice Hobbs was talking about the release in this case. What was fair about it in terms of giving notice to this plaintiff about the design defect? We understand about the inherent risk of tanning.
My recollection of the release in this case is it did not talk about mechanical dangers like sticking your finger into a fan. But it did make clear, and this is what the trial court hung its hat on, the release was all-encompassing. It said, I am releasing any and all claims for personal injuries that I may suffer once I go into the standing booth. And our argument was that was a universal release of anything that could happen. The four-part test as it's applied in negligence cases right now focuses on whether the consumer freely and intelligently waived all claims. And our position at the trial court was all claims means all claims.
From a policy standpoint, let's assume that this particular accident, this type of accident happened, I don't know how many with the product, how many times the product sold, that sort of thing. But let's assume that it happens in 1 out of 10 cases. Would that be a concern of the manufacturer?
I think it would be a concern as a practical matter.
And the manufacturer, what would the manufacturer do? But let's also assume that the manager of the tanning studio said to each one of these persons that was injured, you know, gave them the correct warning so that if we applied your test of subject of plaintiff knowledge and circumstances, there would be no recovery. What would be the manufacturer's interest? What would force the manufacturer into adopting a policy that produced a safer product?
Well, you may remember Ralph Nader wrote a book about a certain kind of car.
Unsafe at any speed?
Right. And that had a profound impact. And I would submit that the clientele, at least high school students who might frequent tanning salons, they talk. People talk. Consumers talk. And again, it's the kind of thing where the market does have an effect on the conduct of manufacturers. It certainly had an effect on General Motors. And I certainly don't quibble with the mandatory safety measures that were imposed by the federal government. But the private market also had an effect on GM's conduct. And they took steps to address some of the issues that were brought to the public attention by Mr. Nader.
Can I follow this up, please? Justice Dunder's line of inquiry here. Do you have the release handy? Could you take a look at it, or shall I read it to you?
I'm sorry, I missed.
Well, here's what the release has, three paragraphs, correct? Can I borrow this, Chief? Yeah, the release has three paragraphs, if you'll see. Correct?
Yes.
Now, I want to read out loud to you the next to the last paragraph. My signature below constitutes my acknowledgement that, one, I've read and understood and understand and fully agree to the foregoing consent. Two, the proposed indoor sun tanning process has been satisfactorily explained to me, and I have all of the information I desire. And three, I hereby give my authorization and consent, right? It refers to the foregoing, right?
Yes.
That is the inherent risk of the tanning. Right here at the very end, you have a one-sentence statement that says, I have read the instructions for proper use of the tanning facilities and do so at my own risk and hereby release the owners, operators, franchisor, or manufacturers from any damage or harm that I might incur due to use of the facilities. Now, how, in light of the fact that this particular release is structured so that it refers back to the foregoing and giving consent, and then refers to some kind of instructions, which we have no idea what those instructions say, whether they relate to these defects or possible defects, or it just has to do with the inherent risk of the tanning process. How in the world, under the four criteria, is this a valid release, just looking at the language here, that would give any kind of fair warning or notice that this has to do anything else beyond or releasing any kind of liability beyond the inherent risk? Just the way this language reads. Would you explain it to me?
It's a fair point, Your Honor. What happens in the trial court is not that we simply provide the release and leave it at that. We provide the release. We say that it means what it says, that in this case, the consumer has received adequate instruction on how to properly use the booth, which presumably would include some reference to the fact that you're going to have a cooling fan in the ceiling because of the heat generated from the lights, that there are appropriate places for you to put your hands during the tanning process. If the plaintiff wants to create a factual dispute that would block summary judgment from being entered by the trial court, the plaintiff is free to bring in some testimony, an affidavit, saying I was not instructed, I've never used one of these things before, somehow I was misled or kept in the dark, if you will, as to how to properly use the tanning booth. The plaintiff's free to somehow explain how a very large fan in the ceiling of the booth is some sort of a hidden danger that she didn't know. She wasn't supposed to stick her fingers through the grill. I'm using the facts of this case, which are somewhat extreme, I'll admit. There can be cases where you've got a different kind of defect and a different kind of product. And I think a trial judge would have no problem in that kind of case saying the release doesn't tell me as a trial judge that this consumer was intelligently waiving his or her rights for this kind of a defect. It's the kind of risk that light bulbs blow up in a tanning booth or something bizarre like that. I can see situations, hypothetical scenarios, where a trial judge would say, I don't think this is a fair situation to enforce this particular waiver of somebody's rights. It's just a case-by-case determination.
Counsel, before you move on, can I ask you to address your argument? I mean, I think you've stated on several occasions what the position of your client is, but I'm just trying to figure out if you're actually trying to make two points. The first of which I gather from your brief is that you don't want a per se rule. You want case by case. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then the second, I guess, is under the case by case analysis, this waiver was fine. This release was fine. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And can you point me to where in the Court of Appeals opinion that second step was developed? What part of the Court of Appeals opinion addressed that second step?
Well, I know the Court of Appeals opinion did go through the four-part analysis.
I understand that. But I'm wondering where it specifically spoke to this, that the release, or there was adequate information before the release was requested. Can you help me understand that? Did the Court of Appeals address that?
I'm not clear on your question entirely. What aspect are you?
Did, I guess to state it differently, did the Court of Appeals make a factual finding here? Did it affirm a factual finding that there was adequate information, or what information was given to this particular plaintiff before she signed the release? Can you help me parse out the Court of Appeals opinion on that ground?
Sure. What the Court of Appeals did was it affirmed what the trial court did. And what the trial court did was focus on whether the last sentence here, I have read the instructions for the proper use of the tanning facilities, do so at my own risk, and hereby release the manufacturers from any damage or harm I might incur. That language, according to the trial court, was all-encompassing. And all the Court of Appeals did here was to say, yes, that language was pretty clear. It was unambiguous. The trial court and the Court of Appeals did not address the issues being raised by the panel today.
Okay. And that's, yeah, that's my the essence of my question is that when you're asking us to affirm, so what exactly are you asking us to affirm? I guess that particular holding or finding that it was all-encompassing, is that what you want us to affirm?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And my second question is, can you direct me to any case or not in this jurisdiction, but anywhere where a release was actually upheld in a defective design context?
Excellent point, Your Honor. My research has not turned up any jurisdiction that has adopted the position that I read being taken by the American Law Institute in the Restatement Third. The Restatement Third came out in the 90s. I would have hoped by now that some court would have addressed it. Not only has no court adopted the position being advocated here by my client, but no court has even addressed what I see as a new position taken by the American Law Institute in the 1990s, which is if there's an adequate showing that a consumer had adequate information and fair bargaining power, then courts should enforce a waiver contract.
So it's basically your position is that you're asking us to do that for the first time in the country, essentially.
This is a cutting-edge issue. I freely admit that.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Moisen, could you address a restatement, Section 18, comments A and D, in regard to whether, if how that would fit into your analysis?
Comment A, as I think I pointed out in my brief, says that this is a general rule. Courts should have a presumption that a waiver contract should not be enforced if you're talking about a products liability claim, except in the circumstances addressed in comment D, as in Doug. And comment D says, and it addresses the points that I've been sort of hammering on here, that the general rule that we will not enforce these waiver contracts does not apply in a situation, if you can show me one, where a consumer has adequate information and fair bargaining power. And this really gets back to the point that Chief Justice Malarkey brought up, which I think is an excellent point. When does a consumer have adequate information about a defective product? And I'm simply arguing that that should be decided on a case-by-case basis rather than the per se blanket prohibition that's being advocated by the plaintiff in this case.
Is the Camacho case any help here?
Pardon?
Is the Camacho case any help to us here? That was a claim of a motorcycle defect because they could have had leg guards on the motorcycle, and therefore the injured party would have had less damage to his legs.
Right. I looked at that case, and that's one where I think a defendant could argue, depending on the sophistication of the plaintiff, that the plaintiff had adequate information and had adequate choices. If a Honda lacks leg guards, but a Kawasaki does have the leg guards, is a consumer allowed by this court to make a decision and be bound by that decision to accept personal responsibility to buy a Honda as opposed to a Kawasaki? Our position is that that's something that a trial court should evaluate on a case-by-case basis. And if you've got a veteran consumer who's been riding a motorcycle for 25 years, that yes, a court should say, or should be enabled to say, that that consumer had sufficient information to make a choice and enter into a contract and accept personal responsibility. If it's a high school student who doesn't know the first thing about motorcycles, this is their first motorcycle, I can see a trial court saying, no, this person didn't have the kind of information background to make a binding decision. So again, it's a case-by-case determination.
And in that particular case, that was, I know that was not an issue, but was there any other product liability case that you cited that took the position you're advocating now?
Oh, as I mentioned just a moment ago, there's not a court in the country that's adopted this issue or even addressed this issue, to my knowledge, after the issuance of the restatement third position.
Thank you.
If there's no further questions, I see my time is up. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to follow up briefly on what I think is counsel's central argument here, to the effect that if a consumer was a sophisticated consumer and had knowledge of potential risks and potential dangers and agreed with knowledge of those dangers to encounter those dangers, so to speak, or go in hand with knowing that the fan is defective, then there probably is a defense to liability under a products liability case, and there is, but doesn't have anything to do with the validity of a release. What counsel is talking about, I would submit, is assumption of risk. In that situation, given the hypothetical that counsel has submitted to the court, the manufacturer in that situation where a consumer with full knowledge of the potential risk that they're encountering voluntarily agrees to assume the risk of injury from that risk, whether it be defective condition, inherent danger or otherwise, the manufacturer has a complete defense of assumption of risk, whether or not any release or exculpatory agreement exists. So I think counsel's talking a little bit
Mr. Chair, your position is, even though the release is ineffective, that nonetheless, in determining whether there is a defense to the product's liability claim, the release becomes evidence of the defendant's knowledge and possible assumption of risk. Is that correct?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor.
The plaintiffs, yeah, excuse me.
But it's not, it's in a different pigeonhole, so to speak. It's not in the, this is a valid.
Could you just repeat that?
It goes in a different legal pigeonhole. It's not, you're not saying this release is, you know, given whatever test the court would devise, this, you know, the exculpatory agreement is enforceable because the consumer is sophisticated, knew of the risk going in, and signed this thing saying, I will assume the risk. That is not the analysis. The analysis is under an express assumption of risk. In other words, the consumer signed this, she was aware of the risk, he voluntarily went in. That is a different legal doctrine. That is a different legal issue.
I understand that. So that release would be evidence of assumption of risk.
Yes. And it would not be a, and you would not need to go through the analysis of whether or not it was legally enforceable as a release per se. Were the court to adopt our position and, you know, take the position that releases of product liability claims are unenforceable per se, at least in consumer transactions, that would not affect assumption of risk. And assumption of risk, as I discussed before, would work either, you know, in an inherent risk that is known to the customer, or a risk that they are advised of or otherwise made known to them.
Mr. Scheer, you agree that this is basically what we would call a case of first impression, the first time we in Colorado or maybe anybody in the United States has had to decide this issue. Is that right?
No, in this court, certainly. It's been addressed and decided in Oklahoma.
What do they say in Oklahoma?
Oklahoma. They say that exculpatory agreements are ineffective to release claims of strict product liability on public policy grounds.
Irrespective of the industry or the product involved, is that what they say?
That's what they say.
Is that what you want us to say, that you just simply can't have an exculpatory agreement which will release the liability of a manufacturing defect?
Yes. I think that's, and counsel talked a little bit about the four-part Jones versus Russell test. I want to talk about that a little bit. I would suggest that test certainly doesn't fit conceptually in a products liability case, but I think it's instructive. There are two parts to the test, essentially. The consideration of the public policy implications of the subject matter involved, in other words, whether it concerns a duty to the public, and whether the type of service performed affects the public interest, and the language and circumstances of the specific contract. Now, counsel in his argument is addressing the second prong, the second area of that test, and I think the court needs to focus its attention on the first area of that test, in other words, the public policy considerations. Now, based on those two considerations, the four-part test, the first two prongs have to do with the public policy. First, the existence of the duty to the public, and second, the nature of the service performed. This court has, as I argued at some length, found repeatedly and firmly that manufacturers do owe a duty to the public not to cause injury from defective products, and they will be held responsible when they do so. The nature of the service performed, again, I think the distinction that needs to be made is Ms. Bowles' claim against Sun Ergoline is not about indoor tanning, it's not about a recreational activity, it is about Sun Ergoline's liability for placing a defective product in the stream of commerce. The nature of the service performed, so to speak, is the actual placing by a manufacturer of a product in the stream of commerce. That is a necessary service that is fundamental to our modern economy. We cannot do without that. Council also talked about Section 18, Restatement 3rd. sure the court has read it. I would submit that Section 18 says clearly and unequivocally that exculpatory agreements are not effective to bar product liability claims as a matter of public policy. Counsel has pointed to Exhibit D, which provides a potential exception to that in unusual circumstances. The circumstances described in Comment D do not apply to the typical consumer transaction such as we have here. I think the Council's first analysis of Section 18 would permit the exception to swallow the rule, and it's not intended to do so.
Is it your position that the amicus brief just misinterprets the Restatement Third?
I believe the Restatement Third was discussed in the answer brief.
Okay. I
would disagree with the interpretation in the answer brief, yes. There are no other questions. I have nothing further.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsels for your arguments in this case. The court will now be in recess. I understand the attorneys have agreed to do questions and answers with the students, who will probably ask you a lot more difficult questions than we